This is Inside Geneva. I'm your host, Imogen Folkes, and this is a Swiss Info production. In today's programme,
Hamas militants record themselves infiltrating a community in Israel close to the Gaza border.
Home to nearly 2.5 million people, the Gaza Strip has been under an air, land and sea blockade imposed by Israel since 2007.
On the first weekend, we lost three paramedics from the Magen David Adom in Israel. These are our colleagues. 3 or 4 days later, we lost another 4 people from the Palestinian Red Crescent. So we can only reiterate the call for the stop of violence, because for us, a life is a life.
To Hamas, for the immediate and unconditional release of the hostages. To Israel, to immediately allow unrestricted access of humanitarian aid to respond to the most basic needs of the people of Gaza, the overwhelming majority of whom are women and children.
An attack is a specific act of violence against one target, and the entire northern Gaza Strip is not possibly a target.
Hello and welcome again to this special edition of Inside Geneva. As I promised you last week, we're going to talk about events in Israel and Gaza. The Israel-Palestine conflict has erupted into the worst violence seen in decades. And as ever in war, civilians on both sides are bearing the brunt. Here in Geneva, the humanitarian agencies have been making ever more desperate pleas for de-escalation and for access to millions of civilians trapped inside Gaza. And since we're home here to the Geneva Conventions and international humanitarian law, legal experts have been looking long and hard at exactly how this conflict is being conducted. So on Inside Geneva, we're going to talk to 2 experts, one legal and one humanitarian, about the challenges of this particular conflict, about what's allowed and what's prohibited, and whether humanitarian agencies will be able to bring any genuine sustainable relief.
Israeli troops are still hunting down armed Palestinians.
An astonishing new image that turns this decades-old conflict around. Palestinians atop a captured tank.
First, let's remember that the horrific attacks by Hamas not only caused worldwide shock, they took the world by surprise too. So when I talked to Marco Sassoli, Professor of International Law at Geneva University, and Benoit Carpentier of the International Red Cross, I began by asking them what their own reactions were when they heard the news.
The massacre Hamas has committed among those festival visitors, or also the deliberate attacks on Israeli towns, are clear violations of international humanitarian law. And my first thought was that I hope that Israel will not fall into the trap of Hamas of doing similar things, also committing violations, and thereby somehow making peace in the Near East even less possible.
Our reaction is to be horrified. We are humanitarians. We are here to help people. And when we see this happening, it's terrible for us. On the first weekend, we lost 3 paramedics from the Magen David Adom in Israel. These are our colleagues, and they were trying to help people. 3 or 4 days later, we lost another 4 people from the Palestinian Red Crescent. So we can only reiterate the call for the stop of violence, because for us, a life is a life, and we need to support people and to do it the best we can.
No electricity, no food, no water, no fuel for Gaza, says Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant.
And in this besieged coastal enclave, water is running out fast.
As you can see, people are waiting, but there's no flour, no water, nor oil.
But as this new round of violence unfolded, it became clear that supporting civilians in the best way possible had become a huge challenge. Hamas had taken more than 100 hostages. In response, Israel sealed off Gaza completely and cut electricity. So I wanted to know from our legal expert, Professor Sassoli, what the laws of war say about this kind of conflict.
Marcus Sassoli, my first question. Some people are a little bit unclear whether the laws of war apply to a group like Hamas and whether when Israel seeks to respond, they need to apply the rules of war in responding to a non-state actor like Hamas.
The question whether this is an international or a non-international armed conflict is a very complicated one. But as you know, international humanitarian law also applies to non-international armed conflict. And it is clear that Hamas is sufficiently organized, and unfortunately, the level of violence now is sufficiently high that it is not just a terrorist attack, but an armed conflict. And international humanitarian law applies to armed conflicts, whoever is right and whoever is wrong.
Let's look at the response then. I mean, we all know that Gaza has had this blockade for well over a decade. But part of the response to these terrible, terrible attacks on Israel was to cut off water and electricity and food.
I had the impression from the very beginning that this was political statements for domestic consumption by Israeli leaders, but in reality, Israel will never be able to let simply all the people die, or most of the people die, because, I mean, without electricity, the hospitals have for some days petrol for generators, but if no petrol is let in, then the hospitals become morgues. And I'm not a specialist, but I think the Gaza Strip needs import of food. Otherwise, these 2 million people simply do not have enough.
Israel has vowed to demolish Hamas after their terror attacks that Israeli authorities say involved the indiscriminate mass killing of civilians, including children and the elderly.
Outside the main hospital in Rafah, the morgue is full.
So, international law applies to Hamas, and all evidence points to violations. And international law applies to Israel's response, however brutal the attack it suffered. Within days, food, fuel, even water were running out in Gaza, and UN aid agencies, unable to get access, began to sound frustrated, even desperate.
People are in a desperate situation. They do desperate things. We know they drink unsafe water. That, we know from experience, tragically, will come with all kinds of health issues. Particularly is our concern, of course, for those who are already most vulnerable, people who may already be sick or weakened or injured, and so on and so forth. If you take away from them their basis for survival, they are likely to die first, including children and infants.
What is clear is that a large number of civilians were brutally killed by Hamas militants who entered Israel. Investigations, credible investigations, and individual criminal responsibility needs to be established. This is essential because we cannot have collective punishment of an entire population on the basis of attacks carried out by militants.
Israel says Hamas is responsible for the suffering of Gaza's civilians.
But there are still aid workers inside Gaza. There's the UN Relief and Works Agency. Its schools in Gaza are currently sheltering tens of thousands of people who hope they won't be targeted there. And there's the Palestinian Red Crescent, partnered, like Israel's Magen David Adom, with the International Red Cross and Red Crescent Federation here in Geneva. The aid workers in Gaza have stayed, despite Israel telling northern Gaza's entire population to move south. The Federation's Benoit Carpentier says that for aid workers in Gaza, each day is a challenge just to stay alive.
The daily life is a mix of trying to go wherever there is a need with the ambulance, for instance, for those who are dealing with the ambulance services. So they are being called almost all the time. While they are doing that, they also have to try to ensure their own safety, which is not granted at all at the moment. Those who are working in the hospitals are receiving patients more and more because there's more and more injured people, and they have less and less means to actually support them. The medicines are running completely short. We're not even sure that our hospitals in Gaza, the two hospitals of the Palestine Red Crescent, have still fuel to run, to have electricity. And in addition, they also have to deal with a massive influx of people that are actually seeking refuge in the hospital. They are on an emergency mode, basically 24/7. Bombing doesn't stop. There's no stop in the attacks, night and day.
There was this call for people in northern Gaza to move south. As you say, it's a very dangerous situation. Asking that many people to move is not a good idea then. It won't keep them safer, because this is what's being said in some quarters. They'll be safer if they go south.
No, I mean, first, logistically, moving 2 million people from one point to the other in the time frame that was originally being requested is technically not possible for many reasons. You're in the middle of a conflict zone, so that is very complicated. You could be in the middle of the crossfire anywhere where you move. You've seen on pictures many, many children. You have elderly, you have sick, wounded people. How do we move all these people from point A to point B? And to be able to do that, you need a safe area where you know that if you move from here to there, you're going to be safe. And that's not the case at all at the moment.
There are also, I suppose, there are people in hospitals who can't actually be moved.
Absolutely. And that's why our colleagues from the Palestine Red Crescent have refused to leave the hospitals in which they're operating, because they don't want to leave their patients behind, because people that are in ICUs, people that have been injured, or even people that were just there before all this started, they just cannot move. There's no means to transport all these people from where they are to any other location.
The desperate flight of people from Gaza as Israel continues its bombing campaign over the north of the territory.
Fleeing for their lives, those living in the north of the Gaza Strip heading south. 1.1 million people were told by Israel they had 24 hours to leave their homes.
Israel's order to the people of northern Gaza to move south was couched as advice and as a warning. We need to target Hamas and you're in the way. Move and you'll be safe. I wanted to know from Marco Sassoli what international law says about such evacuation warnings.
Indeed, warnings are prescribed unless circumstances do not permit, but in relation to an individual attack against a military objective. And the entire northern Gaza Strip is not a military objective. So the idea of this warning is if, say, the Israelis know that one building is a command and control center, they warn the people who live around this building by saying, in 10 minutes, we attack this center. So an attack is a specific act of violence against one target. And the entire northern Gaza Strip is not possibly a target.
The United States has Israel's back. We have the back of the Israeli people. We have their back today. We'll have it tomorrow. We will have it every day.
I've just spoken with Prime Minister Netanyahu to assure him of the UK's steadfast support as Israel defends itself against these appalling attacks. We will do everything that we can to help.
Israel must have that, does have that right to defend herself.
A siege is appropriate. Cutting off power, cutting off water, Sakir?
Well, I think that Israel does have that right. It is an ongoing situation.
You talked about some of the statements you've heard from political leaders, government leaders, being more designed for political consumption. Do you see any double standards here about what's a violation of international law, what's a possible war crime.
Yes, there is a double standard, and this undermines the credibility of the law. I think rightly so. Russia is criticized, for instance, for using weapons with a wide area effect in densely populated areas. I was positively astonished that Western states were so much criticizing Russia for that. But now they cannot say yes, but when Israel is doing it, it is a different thing, especially because the fact that Russia is the aggressor and Israel is defending itself does absolutely not matter for humanitarian law, because both sides, however just or unjust their causes, have to comply with the same rules. And by the way, Hamas would also say that they have a just cause because they are exercising the right to self-determination of the Palestinian people. But this is not a reason not to comply with IHL, which they did not.
Do you think we need more leadership then on what international humanitarian law is? I'm thinking of several, not one, not two, but three or four Western leaders asked straight out whether denial of food and fuel and water was a violation, and they couldn't say.
You know, in my view, they know that this is a violation, but they have the impression that they may, or I hope this is their tactics, that they say, if we recognize the right to self-defense of Israel and then confidentially tell them, look, don't do this and don't do that, this has more effect than if they were publicly criticizing it. You know, it's always that your allies, you rather put pressure on them bilaterally than publicly. I mean, the same thing is true with Western states and some of the violations, for instance, concerning prisoners of war in Ukraine. They don't criticize that publicly, but I trust that they speak bilaterally.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has visited the Rafah border crossing between Egypt and Gaza. He called for it to be opened so that aid can reach Palestinians.
We have 2 million people that is suffering enormously, that has no water, no food, no medicine.
The United Nations says more than 2 million people are at risk of dehydration and waterborne diseases. Now,
and indeed, we've seen political leaders shuttling over to the Middle East, Blinken, Biden, Sunak, and the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres went to Rafah, the border between Egypt and Israel, to plead for aid supplies to be let in. Humanitarian agencies insist any aid operation has to be safe and sustained. The promise of a few trucks here or there won't cut it. The priorities, says Benoit Carpentier, are stark and fundamental.
Safety. We need to ensure safety of civilians and safety of health workers, humanitarian workers on the ground. Our colleagues from the Palestine Red Crescent the other day were telling us, you know, yes, we have no food. Yes, we have no water. Yes, we have no all of these, but we don't even know if we'll be alive tomorrow. So the priority is safety. And then obviously all the essential goods, items that people would need to survive.
Have you got supplies waiting to get in?
Yeah, I mean, not just us. There are many agencies that have been sending supplies at the border. I was hearing yesterday, I think there's 10 kilometers of trucks outside of Rafah that are ready to get in.
How hopeful are you about that? I mean, this program will go out on Tuesday. Are you hopeful that there will be any movement between now and then?
I'm always hopeful. We have to be hopeful because that's the only thing that keeps us going. If we lose hope, then there's no point in continuing doing what we're doing. So yes, we have hope. Now, what we're hearing so far is would be a good step forward and in the right direction. We've been calling for humanitarian aid to access Gaza. Now we have still a very clear idea about how that will happen. What are the conditions around all this? We've heard about 20 or 30 trucks only being allowed, which obviously for a population of 2 million people is a drop in the ocean. It can't be just a once-off opening. It will have to be, you know, a pipeline of humanitarian aid to be able to support people. And it needs to also be reaching all the people in Gaza, and not just at the border or in the south of Gaza. It has to go up north where people are still.
Tens of thousands of people have fled northern Gaza, and many still remain after the Israeli military gave him 24 hours to leave the area before it launches a major ground offensive.
In Gaza, water, fuel and medicines are running out, says the UN, and there's not enough food. Some won't move to the south of the territory, fearing Israeli airstrikes.
Not only are many civilians still in northern Gaza, some, after trying to get to the south amid regular bombing raids, have decided to return north. If we're going to die, one family said, we may as well die in our own beds. So I asked Marco Sassoli, is there an obligation under international law to let aid in, or if people are desperate to escape, to let them out?
I would say let aid in, because let people out, this can end up with ethnic cleansing. And I mean, if you in the current situation with all Israeli warning and so on, people are in a coercive environment and would not choose freely to go out. And indeed, Article 49 of the Geneva Convention foresees that such a displacement could occur to protect the civilian population, but only within the occupied territory. So the idea is that humanitarian assistance must be let in, but Israel has the right to control that it is indeed only humanitarian assistance. And I have heard now some statements saying, but we need guarantees that this will not benefit to Hamas. As such, humanitarian assistance must benefit only to the civilian population, but no one can guarantee, especially in a situation like the Gaza Strip, that a wife or a mother will not also give food to the son or the husband who is a fighter of Hamas. So one can require best efforts, but no one can give guarantees on this.
At the Rafah border crossing, a rare celebratory moment as the gates opened for the first time since the start of the war.
Critically needed humanitarian aid has started rolling into Gaza. 20 trucks loaded with medicine, medical equipment and food that have been waiting at the Rafah crossing in Egypt for days were...
So, as I'm recording this podcast, a trickle of aid has arrived in Gaza. 20 trucks for more than 2 million people. The number of civilians killed is getting close to 5,000. Just a few miles away in Israel, at least 1,300 have died. Just two US hostages have been released. But most families still wait desperately for news of loved ones. I had one last question for Marco Sassoli.
You don't think violations are becoming more common then? I mean, I sometimes wonder in all my long years reporting from Geneva that a lot of the international law that we theoretically live by was brought in the late 1940s in response to the horrors of the Second World War. Do you think that perhaps people are beginning to forget why we thought we really needed that kind of law?
Well, I'm not convinced that the situation was better previously. Think about the bombardments in Vietnam compared with the bombardments, say, of Baghdad in 2003. They have become much more accurate and there is more discrimination. So I'm not one of these who thinks that things become worse and worse. Although I must say that in the last 2 years, there is an upsurge of armed conflicts, including armed conflicts of the traditional kind between major powers, which indeed give the impression, at least if you are not on the ground, that the parties do not even care about humanitarian law. I say this, for instance, about Russia, which doesn't even try, as Israelis do, to justify under humanitarian law what they do.
Is it impossible then, really, to uphold international humanitarian law or the Geneva Conventions in a situation like this?
Well, I think we shouldn't misunderstand humanitarian law. For instance, humanitarian law does not prohibit Hamas to attack Israel and does not prohibit Israel to attack Hamas fighters, military objectives, and so on in the Gaza Strip. And as it is such a densely populated place, this will, even if IHL is perfectly respected, have as a consequence many civilians who will suffer. And humanitarian law was never meant as saying then wars are wonderful. No, wars are terrible, but they are much less terrible if the parties make an effort to comply with humanitarian law.
On that note, and let's hope those warring parties are listening, we come to the end of this edition of Inside Geneva. My thanks to Marco Sassoli and Benoit Carpentier for their time and their thoughts. A reminder that next week on Inside Geneva, we'll be continuing with our series of interviews with UN Human Rights Commissioners, and we'll be talking to Michelle Bachelet.
I didn't want to be the historian of human rights. I wanted to have results. I wanted to improve people's lives. Because the historian is an interesting job, but not for me. That's not what I wanted to do. Human rights will be really, they had to be in the village, in the streets, at the school, etc. No? It's not an abstract concept.
Do join us then. In the meantime, you can catch up on previous editions of Inside Geneva, looking at the situation of women in Afghanistan or human rights defenders in Russia, to debates about artificial intelligence or institutional racism in humanitarian agencies. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. A reminder, you've been listening to Inside Geneva from Swissinfo, the international public media company of Switzerland. Available in many languages as well as English, check out our other content at www.swissinfo.ch. I'm Imogen Folks. Thanks for listening, and do join us next time on Inside Geneva.
Discover science and innovation in Switzerland with the Swiss Connection podcast. In the current series, we visit CERN and explore what they're up to next in their quest to solve the mysteries of the universe. We uncover groundbreaking discoveries in a Roman archaeological site and get the first glimpse of an exciting supersonic plane powered by hydrogen. From the tiniest particles to the vastness of space, satisfy your scientific curiosity by listening to the Swiss Connection podcast for a mind-expanding experience with Swiss Info. Listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Make sure to follow or subscribe to get your latest episode on time.